But I think at the end of the day, we all want the same thing, right? And Emory Lovins puts this really well, right? We want hot showers, cold beers, comfort, mobility, and illumination. When we talk about the energy transition, especially when looking at sub-Saharan Africa, we are not only talking about the high carbon to low carbon technology transition, but also this access to modern energy services.
Diese Stimme gehört Churchill Agutu. Er ist Doktorand am Lehrstuhl für Energie- und Technologiepolitik der ETH Zürich. Und Churchill Agutu ist ein Wissenschaftler, der nicht nur Erkenntnisse liefert, sondern auch an Umsetzungsfragen arbeitet. Darum wird es in dieser Lecture nicht nur sehr spannend, sondern auch sehr konkret. Was können wir von Afrika für die Energiewende lernen? Das ist seine Frage und die hat er im Januar 2022 in Luzern für uns beantwortet. Viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieser Lecture.
Okay. Hi everyone. I'm going to be presenting in English. My German is not there yet. So thank you AHA Festival for having me. This is a really great opportunity. Today I'm here to give you a presentation and just share some insights from my research. And what I'm going to talk to you today about is what can we learn from Africa's energy transition. So my name is Churchill Agutu. I'm a third year PhD student at the Energy and Technology Policy Group at ETH. We are a group of engineers, political scientists, and economists who look at the intersection between technological change, politics, and policy in the context of decarbonization. My work looks at the intersection between technological change and policy, and my research is funded by ETH for Development, and it's an ETH-wide initiative that aims to develop innovative solutions to global challenges and to educate leaders in sustainable development. So if you're interested, you can sign up to the newsletter. It's really a great opportunity for you to network, but then also meet or learn about some of the research and development initiatives at the ETH that are being carried out in the Global South. So I thought I would begin by just talking to you about why the conversation on the energy transition in Africa, and more specifically sub-Saharan Africa, matters to me. And what you see on the screen is an article that was published by the BBC just earlier this year, and it talks about a nationwide blackout in my home country, Kenya. And so what happened was that one of the pylons that supports some of the high voltage transmission lines collapsed. And so there were many parts of the country that didn't have electricity. And that can have many detrimental effects, right? Imagine if today there was no electricity in Luzern, what would have happened even for us coming to this event? And so in addition to that, it also challenges how we think about the way we bring electricity to people and our dependence on centralized infrastructure. Now, the good thing is that because of reductions in technology costs, more specifically solar photovoltaics and batteries, we are already thinking about new ways to bring energy services to people. And these are just two examples. One is an innovation by an engineer called Nora Magero, which is a Vaxi box. So basically it's a box that's powered by solar PV plus battery. And the idea is that it makes it possible to deliver vaccines to parts of the country that are unable to access, do not have infrastructure or do not have equipment to be able to keep vaccines cool. But then the second one also is the off-grid sector, which is really just an opportunity to provide decentralized energy solutions. So bringing electricity to places where the grid may not be able to reach for many reasons. Maybe it's expensive. Maybe the populations are extremely low that it doesn't, from an economic perspective, it's still not possible to bring electricity to some of these regions. But in addition to that, Kenya Power is the utility that provides electricity. They're also riding this wave and thinking about reorienting their businesses towards in the face of solar growth. So let's begin by just thinking about the conveniences and the joys of having access to energy. For me, I really, really love a hot coffee in the morning in winter. I love cocktails in the summer. With trams, I mean, I'm only appreciating this now that I moved to Switzerland. I came here about two and a half years ago, which is just the ability to be able to move relatively flexibly within cities and at relatively low costs. But then in addition to that, especially through winter, you know, there are those days when you're kind of, you know, the 3-4 minutes when you're kind of waiting for the tram and then it gets really, really cold. And as soon as the tram gets there, you sort of jump in and it closes and then there's this heat that sort of wafts. So it keeps you warm. And then the third is just a charged phone, right? Being able to have your phone available when you need it. It's not an obsession with trams, but one of my fears is always that like my phone will die like right at the minute when the tram police comes to like scan my phone. So in general, it makes our lives easier. So for this presentation, I've broken it down into 4 main sections. I'll just give you a bit of context into how we will look at the energy transition. I'll talk to you about the technology options that are available. I'll talk to you about the importance of policy and financing. And then finally, I'll give you some takeaways. So oftentimes when we talk about the energy transition, we tend to think about this movement from high carbon technologies to low carbon technologies. But countries in sub-Saharan Africa also are faced with the additional challenge of transitioning from no access to any energy services to access to modern energy services. Now, this graph is just a graph that compares the energy consumption per person across different parts of the world. I specifically put Germany and Switzerland and then included all the sub-Saharan African countries as well as South Africa. And you can see that Germany and Switzerland consume just about 4 to 5 times the amount of energy that's consumed in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So access to energy is still a challenge in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Just to think of, so when we talk about modern energy services, they can be mainly broken down into 4 main categories. The first is heating and cooling. So for example, the indoor radiators that heat our homes, induction cook stoves powered by electricity, refrigeration to preserve our foods and also to keep vaccines stable. Then we have lighting, which powers our streets and lights our homes and restaurants and the club. We have mobility, which covers a huge range. So I'm just including a few, but trams, tractors that allow for plowing or productive uses. I included a drill just because there's an aspect of movement or mobility. And then I also included motorbikes. And these have become, just out of interest, they've really become a very ubiquitous approach to transport in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And there are quite a few conversations actually about transitions in this context. Then we have electricity, which powers our laptops, powers our phones, powers our remotes, our TVs. When I talk about traditional energy services, from a heating and cooling perspective, examples would include heating through biomass, a yakchal, which is an ice house that's been prevalent in many parts of Persia, and it cools through evaporative cooling. And then we have cooling ourselves down when we're feeling hot, just using cold water. Then we have lighting, which is powered by oil, for instance. Then mobility, in this case, would really be referring to using either human energy or animals. And so walking is an example, relying on livestock for transporting pulling carts, for instance, relying on livestock for farming purposes. And then also just human energy to pump water. So you may have come across this picture before. It is a photo that's been published by NASA, and it just shows the Earth at night. And it gives us a bit of an elaborate view into which parts of the world have access to electricity. We see in the US, we see it in Europe, we see it in Latin America, India as well. When we look at Africa, there are parts of the north. There's the southern part and then parts of Western Africa. But then in many parts of the continent, it's still very dark. Now, 600 million people in sub-Saharan Africa lack access to electricity. And what you see on the screen is just a graph that's showing the total unelectrified population in different parts of the world between the year 2000 to the year 2020. And you can see that in the year 2000, India had the highest unelectrified population, and that has drastically decreased. We also see that there's been decreases in parts of Southeast Asia, as well as the Asia Pacific and the rest of the world. But it's a bit different when you look at sub-Saharan Africa. And so between 2000 and 2014, the population actually increased. But then we see that after that, it has decreased, although much, much slowly compared to the other parts of the world. Now, in addition to that, you will see that a lot of the regions that where electricity access is low, you tend to find that's where there's the highest share of people living in extreme poverty. And so when you look at these two figures, the one on the left shows the total electrified population. You see that sub-Saharan Africa has the lowest rates of electrification. And then when you kind of overlay it and look at the share of people living in extreme poverty, you also see again that it's mostly in sub-Saharan Africa that you have the highest number of people living in extreme poverty. Now, the United Nations has developed a set of sustainable development goals, which intends to reach, which broken down into 17 different categories and intends to reach sustainable development by the year 2030. Sustainable development goal number 7 focuses on affordable and clean energy. And so the goal is to provide universal access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy by the year 2030. And just for your perspective, that means that we have 9 years to find a way to reduce, to bring that number from 600 million to zero. So you can imagine how arduous a task this is going to be. Now, lack of access to electricity denies people opportunities to improve quality of life and also denies them economic growth. So an example is the benefits of access to electricity would be food preservation, for instance, the opportunity to develop local industries, the opportunity to improve productivity. And so these are, this is just a picture of tailors working on mechanical sewing machines. And that's just one opportunity that can be that can be improved through access to electric options. Then you have lighting the streets at night, which is really important for security reasons. Transporting, the developing of cold chains, especially now during the pandemic, that would need to make it possible to get vaccines to every corner of the world, but then every corner in sub-Saharan Africa as well. And then finally, just productive uses such as welding. Now, the thing is, we have the technology that can actually allow us to achieve this. And broadly, you can break it down into 4 main categories. The first is extension of the grid. And so just for illustrative purposes, you have like your source of generation, then you have your transmission and your distribution lines to get the electricity to where you need to get it to. Then you have mini grids, which are more decentralized solutions. And so just for illustrative purposes, you'd have like, these are 3 different sites that are then powered by a mini grid. And typically now more and more, they're being provided through solar PV plus batteries. But then in some contexts, you still have hydro-powered systems and diesel generation in some contexts. Then finally, you have two more categories. You have standalone systems. And typically when they talk about standalone systems, they're referring to something called solar home systems. So you have your solar panel, you have your battery, and then you have basic appliances, so a television, mobile phone charging, a radio, and lighting. But more and more, as the sector is becoming established, they are now developing productive uses or for standalone systems for productive uses. So this is an example of a photo I took in Rwanda about 2 years ago of a solar-powered water pump, which is used for irrigation purposes. Then you have pico-powered solar systems, and these are really just, you know, a lantern, typically referred to solar lantern. So you have your lantern, you have your battery, and then you have your solar panel. And then for illustrative purposes, again, so you'd kind of just be powering like individual loads. So if we then put it together, imagine this is your imaginary country. Typically you have extension of the grid, which has been the means through which you provide electricity. But more and more, because some regions are extremely far from the grid and it doesn't make economic sense to provide it, you then now would opt to look at providing off-grid options. So in regions where, say, the population is dense, you may opt for mini-grids. Where it's much less dense, then maybe you would look at standalone systems. So just to give you a bit of perspective into the different energy services that the different technologies provide. The World Bank has come up with a framework, which they call the multi-tier framework. And basically, it provides a breakdown of the different levels of energy services that could be provided. So it starts from tier zero, which is would considered to be traditional energy services. And then as you go up with the tiers, you provide more kilowatt hours for a set amount of time. So tier one provides basic services for about 4 hours. And as you kind of go up, it goes up, up, up until tier five, which ideally should be able to meet your load requirements for the longest period. Now, in terms of the different technologies, grid extension is able to serve tier one up to tier five level energy services. Mini-grids are capable of going up to tier four. However, at the moment, just from an implementation perspective, they are mostly providing tier three and tier two and tier three level energy services. Then standalone systems, again, go up to tier three. At the moment, they're mostly providing tier two services, although there are some regions now where they're looking at, there are some regions where demand is warranting provision of tier three level services. And then the last one is pico-powered systems, which provide tier one level services. So we have the technology that can allow us to reach this our goal of universal access to modern energy services, but why aren't we, or what is holding us back? So there's two things. The first is policy, and what you see on the screen is just the World Bank's regulatory indicators on sustainable energy, and so it's it focuses specifically on electricity access in this case. And what it does is it's basically a scorecard that ranks different countries based on the policies that they have targeting the electricity sector, electricity access specifically. So the stronger performers are green, middle performers are yellow, weaker performers are red. And you can see that there are just about 9 countries that are green. And the good thing is that these countries actually constitute some of the highest, they contribute significantly to that total unelectrified population. But then you have, so there's about 9, but you still then have a whole 37 countries that still don't have the policies that they need to allow them to scale electricity or deploy electricity access solutions. But in addition to that, the second one is also financing. And so this graph just shows the total, the required annual investment that needs to be made in the electricity sector to be able to reach universal access. And it looked at it in 2019 and compared it to the amount of investment that was being put into electricity access in that specific year. And you can see already that just from a financing perspective, there's a lot of, we're investing much, much less that needs to be put into the sector to deploy the technologies. And these two sort of go hand in hand, and I'm just going to give you two illustrative examples. So Tanzania, for instance, so if you looked at the RISE index, you'd be like, okay, so maybe they have the policies that are targeting electricity access. But as soon as you look at how much is being invested, you'd see that it's not enough, right? So even with the right policies, without the financing, you may not be able to deploy the technologies. And then secondly, this is just another extreme example, which is the Democratic Republic of Congo. In this case, it's a weak performer from a policy perspective, but then also you don't have the financing that you need to be able to scale electricity access. And the DRC also contributes significantly to this unelectrified population. So these are just a few examples to sort of illustrate why these two things are needed. So now we understand the technologies that exist. We understand that policy is important. We understand that financing matters. But then how do we sort of put all these elements together? And so one way that we can do this is looking at the tools that policymakers use to inform policy. And so currently governments in sub-Saharan African countries, as well as international organizations, are developing integrated electrification plans to determine which technology is best suited to electrify a specific area. And these are just examples of headlines from influential international agencies that are well known in the power sector. And they're just highlighting the importance of integrated electrification planning. So these integrated electrification plans are informed by electrification models. And these models are then used to inform policies, right? So which regions get, which technologies are deployed in which areas, what subsidy, which regions receive subsidies, which technologies receive subsidies, how high should these subsidies be. And so they have a huge impact on how you deploy these technologies in working towards reaching electricity access. And it's largely been made possible by the availability of geographic information systems-based tools and data as well. Now, an example of this is shown on the right of your screen. So this is a map of Rwanda, which is a country located in East Africa. And the government has set a goal to reach universal access to electricity, well, in the country specifically by the year 2024. And so the red is regions that would be electrified through the grid. The green is regions that would be electrified through mini grids. They also, in this case, they're called microgrids, but they're the same thing. Then you have standalone systems. Now, the issue with these integrated electrification models is that they typically assume the same financing costs across technologies and across countries. And you can think of the financing cost as just the rate of return that you would that one would expect when they make an investment in a project or a company. And it can really have, it can lead to very unrealistic results, as you will see as part of this presentation. And so together with some of the colleagues in my research group, we wanted to see what would, if we actually accounted for these differences in the financing costs between technologies and countries, how would it then influence the electrification modeling outcomes? So this slide is not intended to scare you. It's really just intended to let you understand that the different technologies that I've talked about are owned by different stakeholders. They are financed differently. And as a result of that, you therefore have different financing costs. So grid extension, for instance, is typically owned by the state network operator. It's financed through the state national budget or through grants. And the financing cost varies significantly. And it really just depends on the country and the quality of institutions or the governing structures. Then you have mini grids, which are typically owned by small electrification companies. In some cases, it's owned by the state. They are financed through concessional loans or through the balance sheet of companies or grants. Their financing cost is high, but that's just because they are more infrastructure-based systems. And so just like grid extension, they also depend on the institutional quality of the country, but then they often have long payback periods. And so as a result of that, the financing cost is high. Then you have standalone systems, and here I'm specifically referring to solar home systems. And these are typically owned by small private companies or just the customer purchases it. They are financed through debt and the balance sheet of these companies, and it ranges between medium to high. These have much shorter payback periods than mini grids, and they typically, they're not really infrastructure based because it's sort of like a product. So you can, and so it's owned by an individual user. And so because of that, the financing costs are lower. And then the last is the pico-powered solar systems, the pico-powered systems, which are typically owned by the user. They are purchased by the customer or offered through microcredit. Their financing costs are usually relatively high because you're providing these small loans to different customers, but then you have very high transaction costs. So because of this, again, because of different owners and different approaches to financing these technologies, you would expect very different financing costs. And so what we did was to define two financing scenarios. There were four, but here I'm only highlighting two specifically. The first is the uniform financing scenario, which is typically assumed in literature and in these models. So in this case, we just we assume the same financing cost for grid extension, for mini grids, and for standalone systems. And then for the niche financing, we defined a second one called the niche financing scenario. And this just represents what the current financing situation looks like, what I've just described now. So in this case, the government would finance extension of the grid, then private off-grid financiers would finance mini-grids and standalone systems. So we then estimated financing costs and then applied it to an electrification model. And what you see on the screen here is just comparing the financing cost if you just look at different countries. So the first thing that you see is that there is differences. So the darker color is the highest and the lightest is the lowest. It ranged between 3% to 19%. And also just for some perspective, Switzerland and Germany would be just around 2%. So it's higher than that. But then you also see differences with the highest being Sudan and the lowest being Botswana. And so this is where it got a bit interesting. And so what you see on the screen is the total. This is what, ideally based on this electrification model, what sub-Saharan African countries would look like in 2030. So the different colors represent which technology would go to which region in 2030. So the regions that are blue would be electrified using the grid. The regions that are red would be electrified using mini grids. The regions that are orange, yellow would be electrified using standalone systems. And so when you look at it, you see that it's very red. So there's a huge share of mini grids. But as soon as you account for the financing costs, so the differences in countries, the differences in technologies, then it changes a bit. So you then see that it's now less red. And so that means that as soon as you account for these technology and country inherent risks, you realize that standalone systems may have a bigger role to play in electrifying parts of the continent than previously assumed. But then what we then did was also to kind of zoom into specific countries and then see, okay, so, you know, what actually, is there any interesting mechanisms that we sort of come across? And so here I'm comparing the Democratic Republic of Congo and I'm comparing Ethiopia. And what you see on the graphs just show the percentage of new connections in 2030. So the again, grid is blue, red is mini grids, and yellow is standalone systems. And the map is just the results of the niche financing scenario. And then here it's the same, but it compares it for Ethiopia. So on the onset, you'd see that, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo is a riskier country than Ethiopia. And so you'd sort of expect that you should have a lower share of mini grids, but we observed that there was very little change. But the reason why this is the case is that we just find that there are many, I call them clusters, but regions where you have these very high density populations. And as a result of that, it therefore allows for economies of scale for mini grids, right? So this is just another layer that adds to say that you can account for the country, you can account for the technology, but the context is still very important as you think about your modeling. This is just a bit of a teaser into kind of like, okay, the next steps into what I'm doing for my research is that we've shown this numerically, but then one thing that also would be interesting would be actually to see, you know, do these technologies actually scale based on what influences how these technologies scale? And so what you see on the screen is just the population of people in Africa, so it's the whole continent, that have been electrified using mini grids and solar home systems specifically. So as I'd mentioned before, solar home systems have really been standalone systems, but over time, only now is that are there now all these new options. So this is kind of focusing on solar home systems. And what you see already is that standalone solar home systems have increased or scaled much more compared to mini grids. And as we had mentioned before, these technology inherent characteristics matter. And so what we're looking at now is trying to then understand sort of when you compare these two technologies, how then do their technology inherent characteristics influence the way markets form, the way the kind of financing that the technologies access, and even how the technology is taken up. The first thing I want to leave you with is just to, first of all, remember and to understand that context is very, very important as you try to understand the energy transition and when you're looking at electricity access. And we saw this through the example where we looked at the Democratic Republic of Congo and Ethiopia. And then policy and finance are extremely important when you're looking at scaling energy service access. So it's not just about the technologies. Then the next is that when we talk about the energy transition, especially when looking at sub-Saharan Africa, we are not only talking about the high carbon to low carbon technology transition, but also this access to modern energy services. For those who are interested to kind of just learn more about the space, I really, really love podcasts. And these are some that I've listened to that I think that give a very good picture into sort of just understanding this electricity access specifically. I think if you listen to this now based on the background that you've gotten, you'd probably understand it a bit more. But so the Energy Talk is one that covers the whole continent. these other three, High Energy Planet also does that, but then the two, they don't necessarily focus on sub-Saharan Africa, but as long as you type like Africa electricity in one of these podcasts, you'll be able to find them. And then I think this is just a bit on a lighter note. A lot of times when we think about, you know, the energy transition, there's this decarbonization versus development perspective, or this movement from no access to access. But I think at the end of the day, we all want the same thing, right? And Emory Lovins puts this really well, right? We want hot showers, cold beers, comfort, mobility, and illumination. Yeah, I also just, one more thing, I just wanted to thank some of my colleagues who helped work on this paper that I've discussed. That's Dr. Florian Egli, Prof. Bjarne Steffen, Dr. Nathan Williams, and my supervisor, Prof. Tobias Schmidt. Thank you.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijasiewicz. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.